ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Todd Achilles, the president and CEO of Edge Spectrum. Todd has spent his career in product, engineering, marketing, and sales roles within the tech and telecom sectors. Previously, Todd was VP and GM for consumer mobility at Hewlett-Packard, where he led the worldwide consumer mobility business unit, as well as HP's global connectivity initiatives. Todd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a little background for our listeners who aren't already familiar with Edge Spectrum. And can you give us a bullet-pointed history in plain language for the Luddites like myself? Because when I read the website, I was like, okay, what does this mean exactly? So if you could just give sort of what the services are and what you provide.
So Edge Spectrum is one of the largest holders of TV broadcast assets in the U.S. So we own 283 licenses and permits that cover about a third of U.S. households. And what we're focused on doing is using the new broadcast standard, ATSC 3.0, which our timing is perfect because the FCC just gave the green light to it on Monday. And we want to use this new standard to deliver a better linear TV experience as well as video on demand with the particular focus on underserved tier 2 and 3 markets. So, you know, our focus is on where most of our licenses are in DMAs kind of 25 and below, which are coincidentally the ones that are most underserved by existing broadband providers.
Okay. Can you explain what ATSC 3.0 is and why it's so important? and also, what it's going to do to change distribution.
So ATSC 3 has been in the works for a while, and it was officially approved by the FCC on November 16th. And there's a group of super smart people that have been driving the standard for call it the last decade. But one of the things that's really impressive about it, and I think the really big deal here, is that for the first time, broadcast is now part of the internet. Because the ATSC 3 standard is IP-based, you know, the ability to deliver content, you can do it the same way that you would do over a cable connection, a DSL connection, or a wireless LTE connection. And what this means is that, you know, broadcasting has kind of lived in its own world where it's had its own standard. Now it's part of the internet. So now it's a peer to everything else that's part of the internet. And that just opens up and unlocks, you know, a tremendous amount of value for the broadcasters. You know, and the standard itself is super interesting. It's, you know, I'm a wireless industry guy. I've spent the last 15 plus years in mobile and wireless and smartphones. ATSC is more spectrally efficient than LTE, which means you can push more information over the air. It's super efficient, and it has all these really cool features in it for enabling broadcasters to deliver advanced services over the air.
So how would net neutrality relate to that, or wouldn't it?
Actually, that's a great question. What it does is, in a post-net neutrality world, which is where we're in right now with the repeal of Title II, there is basically, I think the best way to think about it is that we now have an alternate way to deliver data into the home. When you repeal net neutrality now, you know, the fear is that the existing ISPs, you know, the cable companies in particular, will have control and can pay for access into the home. Now you've got a complementary way to deliver IP packets into the home that gives people alternatives and provides some competition in the market.
Ooh, we love that. Also on your website, you mentioned edge caching. What is that?
So that's the idea of storing, in this case, storing video content at the edge. So in the individual's home. So one of the things that we're doing with our deployment of ATSC 3 and our broadcast licenses is to be able to deliver content from our broadcast towers and then store that in the home. So with the new standard, we can push on the order of 2 terabytes of data, and that can be stored at the home in a home gateway, or it's like a next generation DVR is the right way to think about it.
Oh, okay. So in order to use this service, do I need a special box?
You do. Yep. For anyone that's using ATSC3, because it's not backward compatible, it's going to be a new, basically a new TV tuner. Kind of, emerging TVs will start to support ATSC3, and there'll be a transition over the next couple of years, just like we did when we went to digital TV back in the 90s.
But once this is just how TVs are made for the standard, would I need a box then? Like, is there something proprietary, like the way, let's say, I need an Apple TV thing, like a unit? Do I need that or not?
Yeah, you'll need a little converter box that speaks ATSC3, and that'll hook up into your TV, and that will enable you to watch over the new standard.
I see. Okay. Based on your Medium articles and also Edge Spectrum's overall mission, it seems that challenging the monopolistic tendencies in the telecom and tech industry is important to you. And one of the core issues seems to be the lack of true competition, and that the U.S. consumer doesn't really have a heck of a lot of choice when it comes to choosing a provider. And you want to share some thoughts on that dilemma?
Yeah. You'll have to. We'll see if we run over time just based on this topic. So there's a big problem here. You know, when I first got into networking after grad school, I worked for this little ISP in Seattle, and this is back in early 2000s. And there were, I don't know if you remember back then, but there were ISPs everywhere. There was just tremendous competition after the Telecom Deregulation Act. And companies were just beating each other up trying to come up with new services. If you look at the broadband sector today, it's actually the most concentrated sector of the U.S. economy. And what's resulted is that you've got only 18% of U.S. households have high-speed broadband choice. That is, they have more than one operator who provides more than 100 megabits. So that's only 18% of the U.S. households. The other 82% either can't get high-speed over 100 megs, or they don't have any choice. And so they're subjected to monopoly pricing. And so there's this massive concentration. And frankly, the most loathed service provider sector in the U.S. economy is the cable companies.
Yeah, that's my next question. You're jumping ahead. Yes.
Yeah, and this is, it's interesting as you begin to see people trying to come up with new ways of breaking into the space. T-Mobile, which has done a great job of cracking open the wireless market and bringing innovation there, they acquired Layer 3 TV, and the CEO was explicit in saying, people want choice. They're frustrated that they don't have any options and they have to deal with poor, expensive service.
Right. Is this uniquely a U.S. issue? I mean, for example, I know that like a triple play deal in Louisiana, it's $121 a month for 5 megabits per second. But in South Korea, it'd be $35 a month for 100. I mean, are there structural or underlying policy reasons why this is so?
There are. And there's been a lot of good research done on this, Brookings in particular. But basically, the price of broadband in the U.S. is at least 2x that of other rich countries. The Europeans do a better job of creating a competitive environment. What's emerged here over the last 10 years is really a situation where we've kind of got the worst of both worlds, which is we've got unregulated monopolies managing service in this country. And depending on the state that you're in, Florida is actually one of the best states for competitive broadband. And states like California have, 5 large providers that basically take care of most homes. And folks in California pay $80 to $90 for basic service. That would be $40 or $45 in a competitive market.
I knew it. I knew it was true.
And the problem, and it extends even further. Because
are they just being greedy? I mean, is this...
Well, I mean, listen, they're profit-maximizing companies, right? They're doing what they're supposed to do. I was an officer at a Fortune 50 company at Hewlett-Packard, and you have your obligations to meet your numbers to the street. These guys are doing just that. But, there's a balance here. We think that needs to be struck, and that could be done with more competition. This has serious social impacts. 40% of low-income families with school-aged children don't have high-speed access at home, and their kids fall behind. The graduation rate is 6 to 8 points lower than high school kids who do have broadband. And when it comes to finding a job, you know, somebody that's unemployed in a house with broadband versus a house that's not, there's an 11% difference over time in their ability to find a job. So,
but is that, are those correlations or causal? I mean, certainly about the graduation rates, couldn't that just be, well, because they're low income and that's why the graduation rates are what they are? Just pushing back a teeny bit.
Well, you know, I think the, well, no, it's actually, I think there's a more fundamental question about the data, and that is, you know, is this fundamental infrastructure that everyone should have access to?
Right. Is it a utility that we should all have? Right.
And when you build on that, I mean, the problem is if we're paying sort of twice what we would in a competitive market, it's the families, it's the households at the margin, the families at the margin that fall off. Right. And, you know, given the current levels of inequality in our economy, you know, more and more families are falling off. And listen, if you're not connected today, you're walking around with a 20-pound weight behind you. Right. And life gets a lot tougher.
No, absolutely. I shouldn't be so glib. You know, it seems so back also to the sort of American customer satisfaction index and how unhappy everybody is with their providers. What do you believe needs to happen? Do you think competition would also improve customer satisfaction? That simply having the competition would right that ship?
I think competition is the most important thing that's needed in the broadband sector in the U.S. economy. And that competition comes in a lot of different ways. It's the telcos competing with the cable cos. It's the wireless companies competing with both. And now with the new standard, you know, the opportunities for the broadcasters to join that fight.
That's really, it's interesting and how, what a change that'll make to have you being able to do that. Moving over to innovation and delivery of internet video, what are your thoughts on the big tech companies exploring new mechanisms to deliver broadband faster, more efficiently? Like Facebook and Microsoft are investing heavily in laying their own cable to deliver data across the world. Or Apple recently hiring two Google execs to lead a new team to research providing broadband internet access from space, and Boeing laid out a plan to do so in 2016, and SpaceX is also talking about doing this. So what are your thoughts about those developments?
Clearly, we're not the only one that sees a market opportunity here to deliver IP, right? So I think these are all different ways to solve the problem or to enter the market and compete in the market. It's really a function of what's it cost to deliver a packet of data to a home or to an individual, and then what's the quality of that service? So these are all good things.
Right, right. So just it's all good.
I will say though that when you look at Google Fiber and you know, Google's got a few assets that it can leverage in terms of delivering service, but to see Google pull back from their rollout of fiber, I think speaks to the challenges in the marketplace and how tough it is. Right? I mean, if Google has a tough time competing in this space, what does it mean for the other folks?
Very, very good point that. Yeah. One of the things I'm curious about with the consolidation in the industry where we're seeing, you know, Comcast, their recent move against the Disney Fox acquisition, putting that bid into Sky in Europe, and they sit on a lot of channels. Is there any concern that they won't play nicely with others in terms of they've got a lot of content that obviously you're going to want to be able to access and use? Is that any concern?
You know, I am relatively new to the media space, right? As a wireless industry person, you know, the rules over how people negotiate content and distribute that content, you know, who knows what's going to happen there. But I think certainly the opportunity is there to extract, to take content and control its distribution in a way where you're optimizing, you know, what it does to the bottom line.
You have an advantage because you're building a greenfield company, you know, so you have all the advantages of starting something from scratch, but you're also growing through acquisition. And so I'm interested in terms of how you're built, how you're structuring things differently from legacy companies, but also how you fold in these legacy organizations that you acquire.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You know, it's interesting. We operate with low power TV licenses, and there's more kind of flexibility, and there's less regulatory overhead for LPTV license holders than the full power TV license holders. So yes, it's a lot easier for us to cut over to this new standard and experiment with new services and optimize, because we don't have a big legacy business holding us back. One of the things that's happened through the spectrum auction of the TV licenses and the repack and the process that's going on right now is there's just a bunch of kind of mom and pop low power TV license holders and station operators who've just said, you know what, this is just getting too tough. I can't play in this space anymore. It's too hard. And you know, somebody help me figure out what I should do with my broadcast spectrum in the future. And those are the folks that are coming to us and looking at sort of our vision for the opportunity in the marketplace and saying, hey, let me roll my licenses in with what you guys are doing and let's compete in this together.
Interesting. And also, how, given your background isn't sort of the traditional space, and which I think gives you an openness to different ideas and different ways of thinking, how are you thinking about voice and voice UX?
Oh, that's, you know, that's huge, and it's evolved so much over the last 5 or 10 years, and I think it's an area that's going to continue to mature in terms of voice being the means by which people interact with their devices. There's a lot more to come on that. There's some cool stuff now. It's not, you know, from my perspective, it's about 85% accurate, which is enough to drive me nuts. But it's definitely getting better, and there are a lot of really smart people working on it.
Is that something that you would fold that into your box so that as that tech becomes more robust, it would just be the interface that people could use in order to access things?
Exactly.
Also, given your experience, I'm wondering where you think the future of media and entertainment is heading. You know, sort of a broad, open-ended question.
That's a big one, Gabrielle.
Yeah. Well, I got you here, so hold forth.
Well, the thing that I find really interesting is all the conversation that's going around on about cord cutting, right? And you know, the latest number is, so what is it, about 3.5 million people cut the cord in 2017 from kind of the traditional pay TV.
It was the largest loss in history, I think, for them.
Exactly. And guess what 2018 is going to be?
Larger.
Something north of that. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because I was reflecting with a friend of mine. I mean, when I got out of grad school, I was working for one of the big mobile operators in the Northwest, and this is US West. And I remember talking to one of the executives on the landline side of US West, which was 95% of the revenues back then. And he was like, Todd, don't do this wireless thing. It's not going anywhere. It's too expensive. It's a niche. You know, you gotta join the main part of the business. Fortunately, I didn't. But we've seen this cord cutting before, right? We've seen this happen in the wireless space. And you know, how many homes are like mine where you don't even bother to install a landline? 95% of the U.S. population has mobile service now, right?
Well, this is what I tell when my clients are like, they'll get, once those young people get settled down, they'll get cable. I'm like, they're not getting landlines. I don't think they'll get cable, but.
That's exactly it. You know, and the smartphone space is another one. You know, when I started HTC's business in the US, you know, it was less than 5% of the mix with smartphones. Now it's 77%, the latest numbers from January. And so I think all of this, we've seen this before, and it's going to accelerate. And it's really a function of, you know, who's got the best service with the best value and what's it cost to deliver that. And I really think we're at the cusp of this change. And again, as we look at the space going forward, you know, people are going to cut the cord. So then what's the alternative? Is it an OTT service over, a cable IP connection, or is it going to be, you know, really what ATSC3 enables, which is an OTT service over the air? And we think, you know, we see a future where it's going to be kind of a combination of those two, and it's going to be a function of what's the cost to deploy, what's the quality of service, and are you meeting consumer expectations?
Right, and because you have the OTT capabilities, then you're not locked into only revenue through linear or the lion's share of your revenue through linear, which is the other thing that, you know, is aging people who watch linear. old people like myself. So we have reached the end of our sort of usual interview, but there's a thing I like to do if we have a little time. And so it's, I'm going to say some words, you give me your top of mind response, and I just find it interesting to see how different people react. So are you ready to play the game?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Okay. Facebook.
Russians.
You're the first person to ever say that. Google.
Everywhere.
Snapchat.
Teens.
Twitter.
News.
YouTube.
Long game.
Ad blockers.
Thank you.
Art.
We need more.
VR.
Simulated.
AR.
Additive.
AI.
Optimization.
All very interesting. It's always, those are, people can be all over the map with those. Sometimes, you know, the AR, it's sort of, you know, oh my God, genocide bingo, or I love it. So it's sort of complete span of things. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fun. I really appreciate that you gave us some of your time on today, and thank you.
No, thank you, Gabriel. I've enjoyed it.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Todd Achilles. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.